Welcome to Understanding VC. I'm your host, Rahul. Understanding VC is a show where I talk to VCs to learn how they work. Today, my guest is Sukin. Sukin is a co-founder and managing partner at Iterative, a YC-style accelerator focused exclusively on Southeast Asia. Prior to Iterative, he was an entrepreneur who built Decide.com, a price comparison website which was acquired by eBay in 2013, and Weave, a YC-funded professional networking app. Now let's talk to him. Hey, Sukin. Thanks for joining me today on my podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Cool. So I'd like to start with your background. I read a little bit about you and I saw that you're born in Penang, but then grew up in the US. So yeah, what were your interests growing up? And I would like to know your story from the beginning. And
yeah,
also,
sure. So like you said, I was born in Penang. I lived in Penang until I was about 5 years old. Then we moved to the US. And then my parents made me do this like funny thing where I went to school in the US for 9 months. And then every summer break, I would live in Penang with my grandmother. So from 5 until 18, I would spend every summer in Malaysia. So I think that's kind of like my ties to the region. I always like to tell people I'm more Malaysian than they think, but I think my accent kind of like makes it hard to believe. Let's see, what was I into growing up? My dad worked for Intel since the late 70s, and so there was always a computer in the house. And so I think that's where my brother and I got our start with, you know, programming and computers and that stuff. But honestly, it was playing video games. Like we were like early playing PC games. And back in the day, playing PC games meant you had to like know how the PC worked, because like the programs didn't work very well and you needed to like upgrade your RAM and your like video cards. And so I think that's where our like love for computers kind of stems. But besides that, pretty normal. Played a lot of football, like a lot of football growing up.
Okay.
I went to school and I originally was going to study computer science and I ended up switching to math. So I double majored in math and statistics.
Nice.
My parents were very worried because they were like, what do you do with a math degree? They were like, are you going to be a math teacher? And I was like, no, I'll figure it out. Like, but math is fun. So yeah, then, you know, we started our first company shortly after that, but that's how I grew up.
Cool. So yeah, what was your first startup? I would like to know more about Decide.
Sure. Well, the first... I'm always kind of like, you know, what do you count as the first startup, right? Because if you count the number of products we made, Decide is like startup 35 or something like that.
Okay.
So I think maybe for your listeners, it's more interesting to dig into those kind of like first 2 years. So those first 2 years we spent in my brother's basement. So it was my brother and I, and then Brian Ma and his younger brother. And we probably built 24 products that didn't go anywhere. And the first year we spent an entire year building one product, not talking to any users, not validating anything, just like a bunch of engineers. And we were all technical, just like writing code. And, you know, made the classic mistake of having not talked to users and not done any validating and just run to building a product and then launched it and nobody cared, right? So we made this rule after this product, which was every week we were going to have basically a partner meeting, which we only named it that because we heard venture capitalists had this like partner meeting. We thought it was cool. So we were going to have a partner meeting every Monday. And except we don't have any money, right? So we just have our time. And at the partner meeting, we basically make a decision where, are we going to spend another week on this product or are we going to build a whole new product, right? And if we have a new product, it has to go out by the following partner meeting. It's the only rule we have. So any new like idea or product that we build has to go out in the following week. Doesn't matter what the product is, there's no exceptions. And that is when we made that change, that's really when our fortunes like changed with it, because we went from endless discussions and debates about whether an idea is a good idea or not, and just kind of went into experimentation mode and just like working on products over and over. And then we got really good at building products and validating ideas. And so Decide was kind of like the output of that process.
Okay. So, but why did you guys start building products? Like what piqued the interest?
Yeah. Like why did we get into startups at all?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I think growing up, I was always the kid that was like, I always wanted to build with Legos. And the first time the internet came out, I remember I was on the internet before there was like graphics on the internet. Right. And I was like, oh my gosh, I can like build a thing. So I made a website when it was like really early and learned HTML. And I think there was something in me that just really liked creating stuff. And the internet seemed like the best sandbox you could ever hope for, right? You can like make anything and anybody can use it. And so, I don't know, it just seemed like a lot of fun. I didn't have grand dreams around it. It was just like, this seems like a lot of fun. I remember staying up like late at night, just like building stuff, just like for no reason other than I liked it. And I remember one particular night where I was a consultant for about 18 months and hated every moment of it. And I remember one night Sunday night, I stayed up until 5 a.m. coding this like website. And I remember doing it, all of it. So back in the day, you had to set up the servers yourself. I designed it myself. And I just wanted to see like, how do you do everything from scratch? And it was 5 a.m. I had to get up in like 2 hours to like go to work. And I just remember being like so annoyed that I had to like go to this job and like go to work, right? And I remember just having this strong feeling of like, how do I do what I'm doing for a living, right? Like, that's what I want. Like, this is what I spend all my time doing. I don't want to be bothered by this like other thing, right? And so I think that's when it was like, oh, you want to do a startup. I think my friend told me, I was explaining this to them. They're like, you want to do a startup? And I was like, what's that? And they're like, oh, it's basically what you're doing, but like you raise money and then you like get to do it yourself. And I was like, oh, I want to do that, right? And so I tried to like put together a bunch of founding teams amongst my friends. And the thing that I found out was everybody says they want to do a startup. So this is like the Jack Ma story, right? So like I get 30 of my friends to my house and I'd be like, and I pitch them startup ideas, right? And like half of them are like, Sukhan is dumb, these ideas are terrible. And the half is like, okay, like we should do this. So I said, okay, great. Sunday afternoon, let's meet at this coffee shop and we'll like start working on it. Sunday afternoon comes, I go to the coffee shop and one by one, I get text messages of like, sorry, I can't make it. My like mom got sick or like I'm like stuck at a friend's house. Like just excuses basically, right?
Yeah.
And I remember just, and this happened over and over. And I just remember thinking, oh, I take this much more seriously than other people, right? And like all I really wanted was to find other people that took this as seriously as I did. And so when I met Brian, who was my other partner at Iterative, and we started a bunch of companies together. When I met him, the whole reason we started working together, because he showed up on Sunday. Like he showed up early. So he was the first person that was like, oh, this guy really cares, right? So like I hope we get along, but like he cares. So, you know, that's good enough for me. And then luckily, like, you know, we've been working together for like 15 years now. But you know, that was very fortunate.
Yeah. So I have a very similar story. The first business that I started, I also wanted to just prove to myself that I can build something from scratch.
Yeah.
And then again, so I've been working with the same co-founder for all my businesses because he's the one, the only one kind of wanted to do stuff, really, like rather than just talk about things. So
what was your kind of experience with it? Did you have this kind of like trying to get people to show up at this coffee shop on Sunday and then nobody would ever show up?
No, it was more like, I was living in this estate called Punggol here in Singapore. And then...
come on, I know Punggol. I've been in Singapore for like 4 years. Come on.
Okay, good. So, I mean, a bunch of my friends from college, really smart ones, they just moved to an apartment close to where I was staying. So then I would hang out with them. And then we would always discuss different things. But then there was just one friend of mine who really wanted to do things. And when I started a small t-shirt business back in 2012, he kind of helped me with the design for a couple of t-shirts and stuff. And yeah, after that, like a few years later, he just randomly met a Danish couple on a flight. Like he realized that Lego is from Denmark. And then this guy is a good engineer. So, and he did a lot of these special projects. And then he built a small toy 3D printer. And he asked me whether I would be interested in like turning this into a business. So we've been working together, yeah, ever since.
It's funny how these things kind of like happen, huh?
Yeah.
I think hold on to that though. I think that's, you know, I hate to admit this, but like meeting and working with Brian has probably been like the luckiest professional thing that's kind of like happened to me, right? It's much easier to do these things with somebody else.
Exactly. So it's the same thing. I mean, this person is as important as my wife. So I don't want to to be in a position where I have to find somebody else in the future to build something.
Yeah.
Because you have those years of working experience. Yeah. Working together. Anyway. I would like to know more about Decide and the origin story of Decide.
Yeah. It's not so grand, I guess, but I think there's a good lesson here. So, you know, the way it started is we were doing this, like every week we build a new thing, right? And one week we were like short on ideas. Like we didn't really have an idea for that week. And Brian goes, oh, I got one idea. And we're like, okay. And he's like, so his girlfriend at the time, now his wife, I noticed she kept going back to this Nordstrom's product page every day. Nordstrom is this like retailer in the United States. They sell like clothing and stuff. So anyway, she was looking at this dress and she goes back every day. And he said, hey, why do you go to this page every day? And she's like, oh, I'm waiting for the price to go down. And he was like, oh, we can like build you something to like check it for you and then just emails you if the price goes down, right? And we didn't have a better idea that day. I thought it was a bad idea. I mean, it's like, it's not like a venture backable idea. It's basically a price reminder, which a million people do. But again, we didn't really have a good idea. So like that week we built this thing. And you know, for all the kind of like somewhat technical people out there, you need to build the scraper and you need to build a generalized scraper, which is like quite hard because every web page is like structured differently and all this kind of stuff. So, and we have our 1 week rule. So we built a kind of crappy generalized scraper, but it wasn't very accurate. And so it would go and check pages. And every time it thought the price changed, we would get an alert in a dashboard. And then one of us would go check it by hand. So we wanted to make sure that we were right. And the easiest way to do that was us just to manually do stuff. And didn't have a lot of users, so it wasn't a big problem. So we just made the schedule that was like Tuesdays and Thursdays and Saturdays, Suzanne checks, and then like Monday, Wednesday, you know, like Ian checks or something. So anyway, that's what we did for a week. And like we sent it to a couple of friends and they just started sending it out. And, you know, people started using it. It wasn't that big of a deal. And then I think the biggest thing that came out of it was we just found out that prices moved more often than we thought. So, you know, Amazon changes prices like all the time. And this was back in 2009, right? So like we just weren't aware of this. 2008, I can't remember now. And so much so that our dashboard kept telling us that a price had changed from like $200 to like $175. Then we would go and check and it was $180. And we thought there was a bug, couldn't figure out what the bug was. And then realized that like it wasn't a bug. Prices just kept changing. And so at that point, we were just curious. And so we just started crawling pages like all the time. And then we were like, oh, it's really weird. Like, you know, Costco prices never change, but Nordstrom prices changes a little bit. Amazon changes all the time. And I remember somebody at some point was like, you know what's interesting? You can actually get the same product for less money if you just know when you should buy it. That was like the tagline. And we were like, huh, that is weird. And then we were like, hey, can we like predict this? And again, all recent like computer science grad students or computer science students. And I think machine learning had just like gotten like hot again. This was like 2005 and they're like teaching in undergrad classes. And we remembered that we had a professor named Oren Etzioni who had basically done the same thing, but for flight predictions. So if you go on like Kayak and all this stuff, there's like, is this price going to go up? Is it going to go down? He was the first one to do that. And he was very successful. This company called Faircast sold it to Microsoft for like $250 million, and then it became Bing Travel. So when Bing was first launched, it was actually Bing Travel, and he was our professor. And so we basically like randomly walked up. Yeah, seriously. And so we ran, and look, we were nobodies, right? I mean, we had spent 2 years in a basement, and just went up to him. And we were like, "Hey, we kind of have this idea for this thing. Like, what do you think?" And he's like, "Oh, this is kind of interesting. I know exactly how to do this, right? I did this before." And he said, "Hey, why don't you go like check these three things, like go get a bunch of data and like check for these three things." Right. And we basically became his grad students for like 2 months. And like, he helped us like unravel the problem. And then, you know, the company kind of like grew out of that.
Yeah. Well, this is like a wonderful thing to happen to you. Like when you're the first time founder.
Yeah. I mean, and this is like one of the things that is like, hopefully what we're going to like, hopefully we get to play this role for some people at Iterative, but yeah, totally.
Yeah. So I've read that you guys were able to raise a lot of money. I think specifically $8.5 million or something before pre-product. So,
yeah, I think it was like 2.5 on like 6 or something. So it ended up being like 8.5 or 7.5 or whatever it is. But yeah, that's what it was. Something like that.
Yeah. So why do you think you were able to raise funding pre-product?
Yeah, maybe. So I'll answer your question, but maybe I'll tell a quick story first. So we've been working on this thing with Oren, and he's like, hey, we should start talking to VCs. And we were like, okay, like we don't know what that means. We don't know how this works, right? And he's like, I'll start talking to some VCs. We're like, okay, sure, no worries. And he was like, hey, can you guys put together a pitch deck? It should be like this. And he's like guiding us through it. We're like working on this pitch deck. And then 2 days later, we get an email from him. It's like, hey, come to my house. We have like something to discuss. And we were like, okay. So we had to go over to his house. And we get to his house and he goes, we have a term sheet. And I was like, wait, term sheet is that thing that I read about at TechCrunch. I was like, that's the thing that you get before you get investment, right? And he's like, okay, we have a term sheet. It's like $2.5 million on like $6 million, right? Or 6.5. I forget what the terms are, but something like that, right? And you got to remember, I'm the oldest out of the four of us, and I'm like 23, 24 at that time. And we had just spent the last 2 years in a basement, like building a bunch of stuff that nobody cared about, right? Like our we can't even imagine anything we build is worth anything, right? Yeah. And then all of a sudden you walk into some guy's house and he's like, your company is now worth $6.5 million. They want to give you $2 million, right? For us, we were like, and so I remember he told us that. And we were like shocked, but trying to play it cool, right? I think between the four of us, because we're young kids, we're like, act like we've been here, like, you know, act cool. And like, I think there was like silence for like a very awkward, like 1 or 2 minutes. And then I think like Brian was like, we'll need to discuss it, because, you know, of course you need to discuss it, right? Like, we got to be cool. And he was like, yeah, of course. Yeah, go ahead, discuss it, right? And we go out to the car and then we just like freak out, because we were like, we can't believe this is happening. Like, this is like the thing that we've always like dreamed about happening and all that kind of stuff. And so that was a bit of fun, but, you know, having raised lots of rounds subsequent, fundraising is like, you know, not as kind of like, not the end, not the dream that we kind of thought it was. But in that moment, it was like this really big thing for us. I think it's a couple of things. I mean, I think a large part of it that was like Oren was involved, right? Oren had sold a company based on this technology for like lots of money. And the VC that was giving that term sheet was the same VC that backed him in that previous one. So the pitch was literally like this other company on steroids. It was like Faircast on steroids, I think, right? And it was like, hey, remember when we made a lot of money doing this other thing? We're doing it for this even larger thing, right? Yeah. And oh, by the way, the guy that made that technology is like part of it. And I think to get the deal done, they asked Oren if it was okay if he became a co-founder, right? So he wasn't. He was an advisor at that moment. And I think he came to us and he said, hey, is it okay if I become a co-founder? You know, they're asking that I do, because they want me kind of like more involved in that kind of stuff. And at that point, it was like no-brainer for us. We're like, yes. Please become a co-founder, right? So I think we were somewhat special. It was a special case for us. But, you know, lots of people raise money pre-product these days. So there is ways to kind of like do this. But I think our case was quite special.
Yeah. So one other question. So like, how did you establish trust with Oren? Did you guys at any point feel that, okay, this guy is going to screw us over because he has all the leverage?
He has all the leverage. Every last bit of leverage, right? He knows the VC. Yep. He's the one that knows how to do this. We're a bunch of kids that had been in a basement for 2 years and had like come up with nothing, right?
Yeah.
We asked him. So we asked him once about this years later. And I think one of the moments that we thought about it was, the like answer that we had at the moment was like, what choice do we have? We just go back to the basement, right? Like we were personally running out of money. Like we were going to have to like go get jobs so that we could, you know, refill the bank account so we could try again. We had that conversation. So we didn't have much of a choice, to be honest.
Yeah.
But there was one moment where somebody came to Oren and basically had heard about it and was like, hey, forget those guys. Do it with me. And this guy was much more senior than me, than all of us, and like had actually done stuff and all of this.
Yeah.
And he came to Oren and was like, hey, forget these guys. Like, let's do this, right? And Oren came to us and told us. And Oren was like, hey, just so you know, this guy came to us. I'm absolutely not doing it. I gave you guys my word. That's what we're doing. I'm just telling you guys because like this is something that happened. And he's like, I don't want to talk to this guy anymore. Right. And then like little stuff, Oren invited us to his wedding. I went to his wedding. Right. Like, and so, and again, we were kids. And so I think he went out of his way to like honor his word and kind of like treat us like properly and kind of like make us feel like we were important when he really didn't have to. And so I think, you know, I give him a lot of credit that he like just went out of his way to do this. And I'm sure VCs asked him like, hey, why don't you just do this? Why are you giving these guys so much equity, right? And so we didn't really have much of a choice, but I think Oren just like acted in a way that was so like was someone to kind of be trusted. And, you know, he was kind of a well-known person in the community. So probably there's some part of it too, where it's like, look, he's got a, you know, a reputation. Honestly, he went above and beyond. So I don't even think it was like reputation for like preserving. I think that's just who he is. So he runs Paul Allen's AI Research Institute now, and like my brother worked there for a couple of years afterwards, so you know, we're all kind of like still talk to each other and stuff.
Cool. So what were some of the highs and lows of like Decide?
Oh my gosh.
And eventually selling Decide.
Oh my gosh, there were so many lows. many lows.
Lows are great.
Lows, I mean, look, lows are the reality, right? And, you know, I think there are no highs without lows. And so I think, you know, I wouldn't say you should like dwell in them, but like be prepared for them and kind of like when they come, you kind of like embrace them and kind of deal with them head on, right? And there's going and know they're going to be highs. I think the saying that we learn to say, and I say this to myself now, is it's never as good as you think it is. It's never as good as you think it is, and it's never as bad as you think it is. It's always somewhere in the middle. So we never get that high. We close a round of funding, we're like, yay. All right, back to work, right? And when things go bad and somebody, say the 70th investor says no to us, we're like, that sucks. On to the 71st, right? And that's the only way you can kind of go. Okay, lows. Gosh, there was some moments. I got burnt out really bad during one of the parts. I think so much so that I think the company ground to a halt because of me, and my co-founders staged an intervention to basically be like, you are burnt out. You need to hire people. Because I was consolidating all the product decisions basically to me. And we had a 25-person team and I couldn't make decisions fast enough and I wouldn't delegate. So that was bad. What are some of the highs? I just remember the highs are all people. They're not events, right? They're just we just had a lot of fun. I remember launching, we were in the office with a bunch of the engineers were working on stuff, but marketing people stayed and the designers stayed. And we're all just it was late at night and we're there's sleeping bags underneath people's desks and people were just hanging out. And that was fun, right? And I think the thing I underestimated about what is great about starting companies is you get to choose the people you work with. And if you do it right, you just end up really liking them. And so, I think one of the tougher parts about selling the company was just we get to work together some more at eBay, but not the same, right? Yeah. And so I think walking away from kind of this community that you built within the company, people that you liked, is tough.
Yeah. So why did you guys decide to sell to eBay?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One, it was a good deal. So financially, it's good, especially for I think I was 26 at the time, 27. So that was good. So it was a good deal for us. It was a good deal for kind of investors, everybody kind of involved. So that was good. We've been doing it for 7 years. And so I think we were there was a part of us that was going to be doing this for quite a while. And then I think eBay had an interesting use case of what they were interested in. And part of the acquisition was helping them start eBay's Seattle office. So, we ended up being the core of that. So that was also just interesting. So I think for a lot of reasons, I think it made a lot of sense for us. And so, I think we were looking at raising, a Series C or something like that. But then we started looking at some of these offers and there's actually more than one, but I think eBay's one was kind of the most interesting.
Okay. Could you walk me through the acquisition process?
Yeah. I think every company does this differently. So people shouldn't take this as this is how it works, right? We've gone through a couple of these, not all of them panned out. So I think, they're different all the way around. I think it started out, and fortunately, we had some people at the company who had been part of the Faircast deal. So for example, Mike Fridgen, who was CEO at Decide, he was, I think, VP of sales or product at Faircast. And so he was part of that deal. So he kind of knew how to do this.
Okay.
And then our investors were super helpful. So there was a lot of people that were helpful. And Oren was part of it. And so we got a lot of guidance. I think if it was just up to 25-year-old kids, it would have been a little bit trickier. You learn through the experience. We're fine now, but in the moment, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's a couple things. One is that we got outreach through LinkedIn. A couple of product teams at eBay reached out to us separately and they didn't know. So we start getting these LinkedIn messages and we were like, hey, this other group asked us. And then we were like, okay, these two other groups that messaged us. And finally, I think Corp Dev got together with us and was like, hey, we will organize internally and we'll come back to you. And look, it always starts out looking more like a partnership. That's like code, right? It's like, we want to explore a deep partnership, right? And then the more you talk about it, whatever. And again, I think between the four of us, we would have been like, oh, this is a partnership. And then Oren and the more seasoned guy were like, no, this is how it happens. We're like, <"Okay." laughs> and then so we start talking and then we're having some conversations and then they we start talking about how we can help each other, right? And so we have this conversation and then at some point they want to bring us in to kind of brainstorm and they want to interview some people, key people on our team, and they want to do all this stuff. And what we basically said, which I learned from the more seasoned guy, is that they said, hey, we have to get on the same page of ballpark of how much this deal could potentially kind of be worth, right? Like in my head, if I'm thinking 100 mil and in your head, you're thinking kind of 10 mil, maybe we should stop now, right? Because I think there's a lot of work that needs to get done. And especially from a founder's standpoint, and I would say this to all the founders out there, when you tell your team, it's like letting the genie out of the bottle a little bit, right? There's no putting it back.
Yeah.
Everybody starts calculating their options and equity and all that kind of stuff. And all the products like development kind of just like grinds to a halt. So you really have to like think this through. So anyway, we got to some agreement and then, you know, we did this whole interview process. They interviewed the entire company. And so we had to kind of like help the company prepare for interviews because, you know, obviously it's like, our team was really good. I think a third of the company was like computer science PhDs, but like interviewing is a process. You have to like, you know, kind of like brush up your skills, right? They gave us machine learning challenge. And so they gave us a set of data and they wanted us to build a bunch of data off of it. And apparently it was a competition between us and their internal machine learning, like one of their internal machine learning teams that like who could get like better kind of like recall and like that kind of stuff, which was fun, which our team did over the weekend. And we all kind of like stayed in there and it was fun. So yeah, and then we did that whole interview thing. We kind of agreed on what the work should be. And then it was a lot of negotiations, 6 to 9 months of negotiations to kind of like iron it out. And, you know, people think of deals as kind of like, oh, you sold for this much money, but there's a lot of nuance, right? It's like stock, cash, like retention packages for who? Does the entire company come over? Like, what if they don't want this like associate marketing person, right? It's like, okay, well, you know, does that hold up the entire deal because of this like person or like, you know, how do we like make these choices? And so, yeah, you know, I think in a nutshell, I mean, there's tons of stories underneath that, but like in a nutshell, that's kind of like the stages of it.
How do you feel when you sold the company?
Oh gosh. I get asked this question a lot. Relief. It's relief. And I think a lot of people talk about like, I mean, I think they like assume like I like threw some big party and I was like, oh my God, I like did this thing, like whatever. And honestly, it was like, oh, I can't believe we pulled this off, right? Because, you know, when you run a startup, you just feel like you're going to die all the time.
Every week.
Every week. And we were telling somebody recently and they were like, oh my God, we were talking to a bunch of companies in our batch. And I think somebody was like, hey, you guys say this all the time. And the thing we always say is like, everything is on fire. That's what it feels like to run a startup. Like everything is on fire all the time. And you're just like hoping none of these fires kill you and you can't put them all out. So you're like trying to triage which fire is going to kill you tomorrow and trying to put those out and like looking at the ones that are going to kill you like the next week. But like the ones that are going to kill you in a month, you're like, yeah, I'm not even worried about those. Right. And so it was just relief. It was just relief that we had put out enough fires and somehow put enough fires such that like had built something valuable that like a company like eBay would want to like purchase, right? And like acquire. So it was just relief. I think I wasn't actually with the team when it happened. I was in New York at one of my best friend's wedding and nobody there knew that this was happening. We were sitting at some brunch place and it got released. And then I like was scrolling on my phone to like see it was released. And then when it got released, I like turned over to my friend. My friend like flipped out, was just like yelling at this like brunch place in New York. And I was like, oh my God, like settle down, like chill, right? And the only thing I did that day is I think I bought all my friends, like we were at this brunch place and I think I bought everybody like brunch and that was it. It was like not much else. So yeah, I think it's surreal for like maybe like a day that something like this happens. I think when you start a company, I mean, if you think something like this is likely to happen when you start a company, you're probably kidding yourself. So it's not something we expected. You know, I don't even know if we let ourselves like entertain dreaming about it because it's like, you know, it seems like so far-fetched. So it's a little surreal. And then, you know, I think after that, it's just like, cool. Like, should we build other stuff? Like, what's going on? Right. So,
yeah. Yeah. So what did you build after that?
Yeah. So we started the second company, which we kind of like started on accident, if I'm being honest. It was Brian's bachelor party. This is how big nerds we are. Brian's bachelor party. And we asked him what he wanted to do for his bachelor party. And his groomsmen were my brother, his younger brother, and then a friend of ours named El Pizu, who was a co-founder of our second company. And he was like, I really miss the days of us hacking in a basement. Like, you know, running a 50-person company is like a different thing. He's like, I just miss like hacking on stuff. So we rented a basement in Vancouver, Washington. British Columbia. And we drove up there like 2 hours. And Brian and I were sitting in a car together and kind of trying to come up with ideas to hack on for the weekend. And the goal of the weekend was to like launch some product by Sunday. So we drove up on a Friday night. We're going to launch product by Sunday night and then drive back home. And we're throwing around ideas and Tinder had just come out. And like, I was like showing him, I was like, oh man, Tinder is like kind of interesting. Like you Facebook connect, it automatically pulls your photos. You're like, you download the app and you're like swiping on like real people within like 15 seconds. That's like an incredible onboarding experience. And he was like, there's no way this works. And I was like, I gave him my phone and I was like, start messaging people. So he just like went through my matches and was like, hi. It's people were messaging him back like as I was driving. And he was like, oh my God, people are messaging you. And I'm like, I told you. And so he was like, and he loves professional networking. I mean, again, he dated his like high school sweetheart, so he doesn't care about dating at all. And he was like, somebody should build this for professional networking. And we were like, oh, that's really easy. You could just do like LinkedIn instead of Facebook and whatever. So when we got to Vancouver, we told the other guys and we were like, hey, we want to do this thing. And they're like, cool, that's easy. So honestly, we played more StarCraft than anything else. And then like built a version, like a like easy version of this thing, posted it on Facebook and drove home. And by the time we got home, there was like 500 people that signed up. And within a week, there was like 1,000. And then like 2 months later, it was like 10,000. And it just kind of like grew. And we had just sold the company to eBay. So we were like, is this a company? Like, we weren't sure, right? So yeah, but that's how it started.
Nice. So, I mean, I read one of your tweets. So at a coffee shop, three colleagues sitting next to me are debating whether to build a product that I spent 3 years building. Do I say something? So what do you say to them?
I didn't say anything that day. I didn't say anything to them that day. You know, part of me was like, they were young. I think they were like SMU college students, right? And I think they had like some thesis about how you're trying to come to. And they were trying to do some networking thing. And this is an idea that I think gets recycled a lot. And by the way, Lunch Club is basically where... Lunch Club now is basically where we ended up after those like 3 years. Is like almost the exact same version of a product, except ours is offline and Lunch Club is now online. Yeah. But the Lunch Club guys like talked to us a lot when they first got started. They're like, hey, what'd you guys learn from, you know, whatever. And this whole idea around like, oh, you like opt in and then they match you with somebody, like that's what we started, right? It works much better offline and Lunch Club's a much better execution of it. So like, don't take anything away from those guys. But that's basically what we did. I didn't tell them anything. And part of it was because I don't want to kill anybody's enthusiasm. You know what I mean? And like, I don't want to be the like old head who's like, I did this for 3 years in San Francisco, so you guys shouldn't do it. And here's all the reasons why. Like, that sucks. Like, I don't know. Yeah. Who does that help? Right. And like, they didn't ask for my opinion. If they asked, then like, okay, I would tell them. But like, I'm just some dude at a coffee shop sitting next to them. So I didn't say anything. I don't think they were actually going to start a company. So, but I think what I would say is I always debated how big the market for networking is. I think in startup communities, networking is like part of the fabric how the communities work, right? You're like constantly meeting people. I think the thing that we ran into was, does the average person who works a 9-to-5 job care that much, right?
Yeah.
And in our, my opinion on the space now is like, not really. Like, yeah, more or less, they want to do their job and they want to go home, right? Like, they don't want to spend an extra 3 hours a week, even an hour a week, like meeting somebody new. Maybe if they're looking for a job, they'll spend it, but like, not in like, on a regular basis, where, you know, startup people like you and I are like, we're constantly like, oh, I want to meet this new founder and like somebody who got introduced to me. And we're like doing this all the time, right?
Yeah.
VCs especially, I feel like VCs is like my, basically my job now. So yeah, I think I would have probably like asked them like, you know, how big can this like really get, right? If you're only servicing kind of startup communities, is that good enough? Now this might have changed a little bit because startup communities have like gotten much bigger and it's like more global now. So like maybe that works, but that's probably what I would have said.
Yeah, I think there's still a small group of people who likes to go on like, physical meetups and stuff.
Yeah.
You find a lot of them in meetup.com, even here in Singapore.
Yeah. And look, I've got a couple friends that are working on products that are like kind of like this and they reach out. And I, you know, we collectively, all the Weave crew, we get emails from people who are like building something that's similar like this and they want to know what our experience is like. And so, yeah, people are still working on it. I do think networking still kind of sucks, so it's still a problem. I just wonder if it's like, you know, a venture scale can be worth $1 billion kind of problem.
Yeah. Another problem that I used Lunch Club for a while, but then I completely stopped using it mostly because I was not able to meet founders and VCs through Lunch Club. They would, you know, set me up with a kind of a founder or a kind of a VC. I'm not interested.
So we ran into these problems. So two problems that you described. One, there is a group of people that everybody wants to meet, and that group of people does not really want to meet everybody else, right? So there's this like asymmetry thing. So two, you can't tell who is like legit and not legit. We did it because we were hand approving people, right? But again, then you can't scale. So like, how does that like work? So yeah, I don't know. Challenging problems.
Okay. So what happened to Weave in the end? So I know that it was YC funded and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, we went through YC. We raised some money from Index. We, you know, we did our first startup in Seattle. And so we really wanted to go down to San Francisco and like see what the valley was like, right? I think the thing we always say is, if you're doing startups, at least in the US, maybe other places too, but you're not in San Francisco, it feels like you're an actor and you don't live in LA, right? It's like, you got to like get down to where the Mecca is. Yeah, I think we basically like, it started out as Tinder for professional networking. It ended up being an offline version of Lunch Club. And then we started getting pessimistic on how big this like market could be. I think I can talk about this now. We were very close to having a deal with LinkedIn, and then Microsoft bought LinkedIn, and then the deal went cold. I hope there's been enough years of statutes of limitations for me to like talk about that, but we were like very close there. And we had told our team, and so product development, after we told the team, product development kind of like installed, and then this deal kind of like fell through. And then we ended up selling it for kind of like a very like small deal, much smaller than the first deal, to somebody who wanted to like roll it into one of their products. So yeah. And then after that, I took a year off and I just was traveling around, and that's how I ended up in Southeast Asia. I was spending a bunch of time in Southeast Asia and getting more excited about it. And then Brian started Divi Homes, which is like an enormous company now. And yeah, he still gives me a hard time because he was like, hey, we're going to co-found this third company together. And I was like, I think I'm moving to Singapore. And he like didn't talk to me for like 2 weeks. He was like so pissed.
Okay.
And then, I mean, Divi is like huge now, right? I think if they're not already a unicorn, they like are going to be very soon. And I remember when he first started, I was like, hey, I hope Divi shareholders aren't mad at this. None of our friends got into the deal except for my family. And I basically was like, dude, you have to get me in, because it's like we start two companies together. And if the third one gets really big and it's the one that you did without me, everybody's going to be like, Suken was holding you back. And I was like, I can't root for you. So he let me put a little bit of money. But now we're working together again, which is awesome. But yeah.
Cool. So I'd like to know a little bit more about Iterative and what you guys are doing.
Yeah. So, you know, I think the thesis came down from like, after a bunch of these companies, we started doing more angel investing, and primarily because, like, I think when you're busy doing startups, you just don't think about angel investing. Okay, at first we didn't have any money, so okay, we couldn't do any angel investing. Then, you know, we sold the company and some of this stuff, so we had a little bit of money, but we were too busy with the second company like to think about it. And then we basically missed out on a bunch of stuff. So a bunch of our friends started companies that like did really well, and we were like, oh, we totally could have invested in them. Like, crap. We should be investing in companies, right? So like, for example, the co-founders of Airtable are like college friends of mine. Like, I knew them before they had like a product, right? And I was like, how did I not invest in that? Like, dang it, right? And so we have just like a ton of stories like this. And so we were like, hey, we should like take this investing thing more seriously because we like know people. So a bunch of us got together and we started pooling our money to write like 25K checks, right? And we had no idea what we were doing. So we were just like, we just want to get reps. So let's like, basically, let's do as many deals as we can for as little as we can, because we're probably bad at this, but like we need to like try. And so, yeah, we got a bunch of deal flow from like YC. One of the guys in our group was like very, very early at Facebook, maybe like first like couple hundred. And so he's like locked into this whole like inner Facebook group that like we get a bunch of deal flow. Brian was doing a lot of prop tech stuff, was getting hot. So Brian gets like all the prop tech deals. So, you know, we had some pretty good deal flow. And so we started doing that. So we're like 40 angel investments in and zero in Southeast Asia, none. And we had invested in a remittance company in Venezuela, which none of us have even been to. We had an online pharmacy in India, which again, none of us have been to. We invested in a space tugboat company. Like, we don't know anything about, okay, one of us kind of knows a little bit about that. But like, we invested in all these things and no Southeast Asia. And so all of my other partners were like, what the heck? Like, you are from Southeast Asia. You live in Southeast Asia now. Like, why are we not investing in Southeast Asia? And I basically said, hey, there's so much opportunity here. But all the founders I meet, they're all first-time founders. And I feel like they're making classic first-time founder mistakes. And I feel like if I could spend like a day a week with them, I feel like I would invest. And they're like, sounds like early YC. They're like, who's YC in Southeast Asia? And I was like, well, there's a million accelerators, but none. And they're like, how is there none? And I said, well, most of the accelerators are not run by people who have started companies before, right? We're like in that stage of the ecosystem. And, you know, we kind of think that the magic of YC is second and third time founders kind of like helping first time founders, right? Like if you look at the YC partners, they're like, you know, varying levels of success, but like I've done this before. And we think that's important because I think being a founder is like a very unique experience. And unless you've been one, it's hard to like empathize on like a very kind of like emotional level. And a lot of being a founder is like actually kind of the emotional part. It kind of like dealing with the like lows and the highs and everything in between and all of that, right? Like, it's not just like, here's how you look at distribution channels and here's how you calculate CAC and like blah, blah, blah. It's like, there's that stuff, but you got to manage all this other stuff, right?
Yeah. And so there's this line from your blog post that I really like. We've been told by investors that our idea was too small, too big, or just dumb. We've gone from thinking we would be the first next Facebook to wondering what we're doing with our lives. We've been you. That really explains it all.
You know, it's funny. I wrote that line as kind of just like a throwaway line. And tons of people, that's resonated with lots of people, right? And like, yeah. I think that's because, like, I mean, you kind of worked on some stuff. You felt probably all of those things, right?
Yeah.
And it's like the whole gamut. And so
it's with everyone who has built stuff.
Everybody's built stuff, right? And I think I think it's just important that, like, you know, we've like felt that too. So there's a little bit more empathy there. So yeah, you know, and then as we talked about it more, somebody was like, why don't we do it? And so we actually went and talked to YC. We were like, hey, YC, you want to do YC Southeast Asia? We'll do it for you guys. And they were like, oh, we're pulling out of China. This was when YC had China, YC China. They're like, we're going to send you to San Francisco. So we said, okay, you know, fair enough. Why don't we just do this, right? We help companies all the time. We might as well just formalize this. I don't know how I convinced Brian to leave his like, you know, very, very like fast growing startup to come work on this with me. But once he was like, hey, I'd do this with you if you want to do it. I was like, oh, well, if you're in, like, I will definitely do this, right? So we're on a third batch now. I think we have, what is it? We have 8 and 10. So what is that? 26? 26? Gosh, I have a math degree too. It's terrible.
Yeah.
So we have 26 companies we've invested in. It's our third batch. And it's been going really well. Gosh, one of the things we learned in the first batch is, I think being founders, we get so invested in people's companies because it's like we just identify so much with them. So when the companies have like bad days, we have bad days, and we had to like actually have a conversation about like how we distance ourselves a little bit because we're too attached, you know? And it actually doesn't help the founders. So how do we like keep some of this empathy, but like don't like take on the same feelings, right?
Yeah. So it's kind of like running 10 different startups when you invest in 10.
Yeah, let me be very clear. I get what you're saying. We definitely don't run all 10 startups, right? Because it's like the founders definitely run the startups. We help them and all that kind of stuff. But like, I always want to put focus back on the founders. Like, they are doing the hard work, right?
Yeah.
It's easy for guys like me to like show up and be like, hey, you should like do these things and that, you know, and hopefully we can be helpful. But like, we don't do the hard work, right? The founders do the hard work.
Yeah. So the one thing that I notice is when you hear VC speak, you know, they talk about their portfolio companies as we, as if it's like, yo, we're also part of that. So I mean, you inevitably feel part of that that entity, right?
I think I'm mixed about that, right? Because I think it's on some level, like, I get it. You want to feel like you're part of the team, right? But there's a little bit of like, you're like not in the same way, right? Like, if you were starting a company and I was an investor, even though you went through our program and like, you know, I'm trying to help your company, dude, I probably spend 4 or 5 hours a week per company. So like we work with them a lot. And I mean, we do a lot of founder therapy. Founders have been like crying, like when we like talk to them and stuff. So we get pretty close, probably more closer than like most investors. And I still am like, you know, if one of the companies does really well, it's like, I feel like saying we almost kind of like shortchanges them because it's like, you guys put in the effort, right? We put in some, you put in the lion's share of the effort and you get the lion's share of the success. So if this company becomes $1 billion company, you made it $1 billion company. I didn't make it $1 billion company, right? So I think sometimes having been the founder before, knowing what like toll that takes on a person, I would never take that credit away from them, right?
Yeah.
Like, I help. I like respond to some emails and I get on phone calls with you and I talk to you about stuff, right? But like, I didn't breathe this day in, day out for like years. I didn't have the like highs and lows. I didn't like, you know, I didn't have the moment when I thought the company was going to fail and like, I was going to like throw away the last 5 years of my life. I'm an investor. I will never feel that in your company, right? So, you know, I shouldn't share in your credit of like, oh, you became $1 billion company. That's you. Right. So I don't know. I feel quite strongly that I think sometimes investors like take too much credit for like having invested. And sometimes honestly, all they do is say yes. So like, right. So.
So one specific question for anybody who wants to maybe apply for iTrader. So what stage a startup must be? Because I remember many years back when I was applying to YC, you know, they have these bunch of questions. And one of the things that they mention in the form is that you can even start, I mean, you can even apply with an idea.
Yes.
So, but the year that I was applying to, probably in 2014 or something, that was never going to happen. So they had reached too much of maturity to a point where, yeah, they want to see serious traction before they would even just invite you for an interview. So I think the accelerator also go through like a maturing process and stages. So yeah, where are you guys?
I mean, look, we've definitely invested in companies with just an idea, right? So like last batch, I think there was like specifically a company that was like basically just an idea and like two guys that just graduated from college. So we're definitely there. But I also know people that get into YC now with just an idea. So think about it this way. YC and us, right? They need something to hang the investment on, right? And so it could be if you have nothing else, a lot of traction helps. But if you don't have a lot of traction, there needs to be something else, right? And so do the founders have some like really unique experience or domain knowledge or something like that? That is like, oh my gosh, it's like so strong I can like hang an investment on that, right? So
yeah,
I think traction is not the only like vector here, but you need to have something. Yeah. I think the other thing that I would talk about too is product is a very, turns out, nebulous term, or maybe kind of like fuzzy term. So, you know, we have some friends who've kind of like got into YC with just like, they just have validation numbers. Like they made a landing page and all these people signed up and they don't have any product behind it. Or maybe they did a bunch of manual stuff behind it. So I don't know what you call a product. They didn't have like an app in the app store. And I think, you know, just knowing quite a bit of YC partners and stuff and us, we see no difference, right? I actually would rather invest I'd rather invest at the stage where people have like, all these people want this and all I'm doing is building something out of a spreadsheet right now. I'd rather invest in that stage than at the stage that like somebody built a product. So if you gave me the same user numbers and maybe like no product as opposed to a product, I'd probably take the no product one. So yeah, does that help kind of like answer?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it really shows that, I mean, there has to be some clear signal for an investor. Yeah.
Well, actually, let me break that down into like actual pieces. Traction is one piece. Founders is another piece. Idea is one piece too, right? So I would argue if you have two of the three, you're in reasonably good shape. If you have one of the three, it needs to be like exceptional. And if you have zero of the three, then like there's nothing anybody's going to invest in, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, the reason why I asked is just because recently I was speaking to someone who had someone else, a friend of her or something, who had applied for iTrader and then they did not get it. The reason, at least what she told me, was that they did not have enough traction. So this is something that a lot of VCs in the region as well keeps talking about. So there are definitely other factors as well, right? Like if you have a great team, I mean, if you have domain expertise and something like that, you don't need traction. People will just bet on you based on that.
But here's the thing. Validation is like, just get validation. Like, it doesn't cost very much money to get validation these days. And actually, you know, this is one of the things that I'm like quite big on. And I want to start a whole new program that Iterative does based on this. Like, we have our accelerator program, but I want to start a bunch of other ones. Is teaching how to get like validation without building a product like how to do it in like 2 weeks. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes when I, you know, I don't know who your friend was, you know, now I'm like curious, like I want to like go look up their like application. But I think one of the things that people have to remember too is for some ideas, when I see that they haven't tried to get validation, I sometimes reject the application, not because they haven't done validation, but because like they haven't thought to do it. Do you know what I mean? Like, what does that indicate about them as a founder more than it's like them having done it, you know? And so, yeah, I that ends up happening a lot. It's just like, wait, why didn't you try to like get 500 people to sign up for this? Like, why didn't you build a landing page? Why didn't you, you know? So yeah, it kind of tells us a lot about like how the founder thinks, especially if they spent like all this time, like, I don't know. I get very telltale signs for me of like people that have like wrong priorities. They have like a super polished pitch deck and like no validation. I'm like, you spent your time on the wrong things. You have a really well-designed website, but like, again, like no like validation numbers around it. Like again, like you spent Or like, I don't know, your visual design is amazing, but your like actual kind of like UX sucks. It's like, okay, again, spend it on things. So, you know, I think there's like, we often look at applications this as a way to see what the founders prioritize and whether that is the type of prioritization that is, you know, the type of companies that we like working
with. Yeah, I think I get what you mean. So, I mean, when you're starting off, you're starting off with an idea and then you sound very excited. Sometimes founders tend to hold off this whole validation thing because maybe, you know, it gives like a false sense of like, you know, excitement or whatever. Because the minute you go for the validation and then if it's a negative thing, things are not working, then you know, okay.
Totally. I think so. I think what you're saying, I think, is the number one thing. People, it's where the rubber meets the road, right?
Yeah,
it's like exactly. everybody thinks you're the next Facebook until you launch your product, then you realize you are not the next Facebook, right? And like, that sucks. Like, that's like painful.
And nobody wants to have that realization.
Nobody wants to have that realization, right?
Yeah.
And then I think the second thing is people always are too embarrassed to like launch some crappy version, right? And Reid Hoffman, you know, the LinkedIn founder, has a very famous saying, which is, you know, if you're not embarrassed by the first version of your product, you waited too long. And that's 100% true, right? I don't know how many applications we get and it's like, oh, I've been working on our first MVP for the last 3 months and it's going to be launched in the next 3 months. And I'm like, that's not an MVP and you should have launched 2 months ago, right? But they want to build all these features and like, you know, we want to make sure that it's like perfect before it goes out and all this stuff. And I think the thing that people get wrong is you don't know what the market wants, right? You're assuming you know what the market wants. And if you do, you're a much better entrepreneur than me because like I've never been able to figure that out, right? I have guesses and then I like, and look, we name the fun iterative because that's how we think about stuff, right? That's how we think about it, right? It's like you have a thesis, you get it out there, you try, you keep working, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So I have a hypothetical question. So I'm a founder. I'm applying for both YC and Iterative. I got into both. Why should I choose Iterative?
Yeah, good question. By the way, both good, right? I'm like not here to slander YC. And so I think the thing is we're both accelerators, but we're at different stages of the accelerator like stuff, right? You alluded to this. YC is like 200, 300 companies now?
Yeah.
Right?
200 plus, I think.
200 plus, right? And so I think the level of engagement is just like lower, right? So I don't know, you know, I don't know if most people know this about YC, but you can kind of get through YC and not go to anything. Like, you book office hours if you want to book office hours, but you kind of don't have to. You don't have to show up for the dinners, right? And the group office hours, I think, are kind of like mandatory. And you don't have to pitch a demo day, right? So it's a little bit of like, make it what you will. And by the way, if you go to YC, like book everything, right? Like meet with as many partners and like do everything. Get as much as you can out of it. But, you know, even then, I think there's kind of less time because there's so many companies, right? So our current batch right now is 10. And again, Brian and I spend like a couple hours with each company every week. So much so that like I've been on interview loops for companies. I've like done database schema reviews. I've like done like design reviews. You know, we've done founder therapies. Like I think we just go deeper than YC does. So maybe the way to think about it is YC has a bigger network than us. I'm not about to tell you that they don't. They've been around for 16 years. They have a bigger network than we do, right? Yeah. So look, if you primarily want to get plugged into kind of this, like the YC network, which is very valuable, like do YC. We're not replicating that. If you want to get an experience that's similar to like early days YC, then you should join our program, right? Because I think our program looks more like the Paul Graham YC. When it was like early days, you really get to know people. The batch sizes are small. The community is like closer knit, that kind of stuff. And we get more hands-on. You know, a part of it too is like we're more localized than YC. I mean, YC is like doing startup stuff everywhere, right?
Yeah.
I had one company that went to a YC interview and I think the partner thought Jakarta was like in Taiwan or China or something like that, right? Like I had no idea where Jakarta was. And so look, not all YC partners are like this. Like let's not paint a broad stroke, but like, they don't understand the nuances as much, right? So you know, I think those are the two parts. If you want something that's a little bit more close-knit and kind of like early YC and maybe more targeted towards the region, then I think, you know, maybe we're a good choice. But, you know, YC has this like broader brand that is like really valuable, right? We've benefited from it. So, I think both good choices.
Okay. So I have a question. Let's say the future of Iterative is also going to kind of follow the same path as YC, right? Because considering the power law of VCs, and you would want more startups to be part of the batch for you to maybe succeed. I mean, I get a higher rate of return on your investment.
I guess we think about it differently. I mean, that's probably true from a financial standpoint. But I think what we're doing more, and this is how YC thinks of itself, we're building a community. Our accelerator is just orientation into the community, right? And look, we want to like internally, our like vision is we want to increase the GDP of Southeast Asia. And if we just do it at 10 companies at a time, we're not increasing the GDP of Southeast Asia. And look, that's a pretty lofty goal. But like, if we have any shot at moving at like 0.1%, we've got to kind of like grow the community. I think the other thing too is we want to be able to just like reach more entrepreneurship. We want entrepreneurship to be more accessible in Southeast Asia. And again, I think if you keep it at only 10 companies a batch, it's never going to be that accessible, right? And so we need to expand it so we can kind of like do all of these things. But we need to do it in a way that where the program is still helpful to the companies, right? So, I mean, look, yeah. If I let in 60 companies like the next batch, like A, I don't know how we support 60 companies right now. Doesn't make any, like B, can we find 60 good companies right now? I don't know, right? Does the ecosystem produce 60 good companies? And so we need 120 companies since we do two batches a year? I don't know. So we need to kind of pace ourselves with like how we develop the program and kind of like how like the ecosystem is
developing. The ecosystem matures, yeah.
So we need to do both. Yeah. And also, look, we've said no to some companies basically because we were like, we don't want these people in our community. Like we just don't like them. Like we're like, I don't know if this is a good person. You know what I mean? And so I think, you know, look, starting a community, we think about it like starting a company. You get that core group of people and you set the culture and you do it right. And you kind of like are very picky about that. And then that, like, as you kind of get bigger, that culture kind of self-reinforces. But if you go too big too quickly, you don't get a chance to build that culture. And then, you know, it kind of gets a mess, right? And I think YC has done a good job of this. So yeah, hopefully we can kind of reproduce some of that.
So what are you excited about? Like for the future, considering the fact that you moved back from US to Southeast Asia?
I mean, a bunch of things, right? So look, I feel like sometimes, you know, we won't get too political, but at least in Silicon Valley and at least in tech startups, having spent some time in Silicon Valley is like almost like it feels like you're coming from the future, right? Like I've seen how this plays out in ecosystems, right? So if you think of Silicon Valley as like a late stage tech ecosystem, I would put Southeast Asia as like early stage, right? And look, nothing against any of the people here. Everybody's working their best, right? It just takes time. And I think what I'm excited for is for Southeast Asia to like make that leap. And to me, there's no reason why I can't do that. You know, this is self-serving because I'm like from the region, but when I meet people here, the founders here are just as good as anybody in Silicon Valley, right? Like raw materials, like they're just as bright as anybody from there. And honestly, I think they have a little bit more grit than the people in Silicon Valley. And I'm just excited for all of those people to get the support and development that they like want and need so that the ecosystem can kind of go. And I just thought that like it would be very exciting to play a part in that. Ryan and I talked about starting a fourth company. We're like, oh, should we start a fourth company? Maybe we should do a venture builder, like all this kind of stuff. And I think at the end of the day, YC is like this institution in Silicon Valley. And the idea of building a similar institution in Southeast Asia was much more appealing than starting a fourth company. Even if like that fourth company was like a unicorn, I'd be like, I'd much rather have started YC Southeast Asia than like, you know, Southeast Asia unicorn. Both are great, by the way. Like I'd be so lucky, right? Yeah. But if I get to choose, and I do, that's what I'd like to do. And so I found this like unique niche where I think there needs to be a little bit more like founders helping founders in Southeast Asia. And I think I'm fortunate that I have some of that background. And so, you know, I'd like to like put that to use if I can, you know, as helpful as I can be, I'd like to be that. So I think that's really exciting for me.
So yeah, this has been an awesome conversation. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
If you like this podcast, please do subscribe at understandingvc.com and leave us a review.